Hello, I'm Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, the new IMF historian Harold James talks about globalization and how the past might help guide us into the future.
In some ways, the 19th century is particularly good at learning these lessons about the interplay of migration with technical change and also with social upheaval.
Harold James and fellow historian Rex Gosh have started working on the newest volume of the IMF's official history. James is professor of history and international affairs at Princeton University and wrote an article about globalization entitled New Concept, Old Reality, published in the December 2016 edition of Finance and Development magazine.
Most people would define globalization as, in terms of trade. How would you define globalization, and especially given your new role as the historian at the IMF, how long has the concept been around for?
Well, I think of globalization not just in terms of trade, but in terms of everything that moves across national frontiers. So if we think of it in economic terms, it's about the movement of goods, obviously, of trade, but also of the movement of people, migration, the movement of capital, and also, I think, importantly, the movement of ideas, so technical changes. The term itself, I think, only really begins to be used in its modern meaning in the late 1960s or early 1970s. The very, very first instance I found of it was in a rather obscure radical left-wing publication in Italy in the late 1960s, when it's primarily aimed at multinational corporations and at IBM in particular. But the actual reality of globalization is much older than that. And most historians, I think most economic historians, agree that there was what is widely now called the first age of globalization in the 19th century, when there was also a big acceleration of movements of goods and capital and labor and of course ideas across frontiers. But actually, I think that label of the first age of globalization is wrong, in the sense that there were these movements hundreds and even thousands of years before. And in a sense, the world at the time of the Roman Empire was also globalized, and we're just beginning to realize the extent of the globalization of ancient times.
And so why do you think there's such a backlash against globalization these days?
Again, one of the things that the article wanted to do was to point out that these backlashes are constant and recurring features when people worry that there's too much interconnectedness. So even in Aristotle, there's a worry about goods being produced too far away and luxury goods coming from long distances, and that resurfaces again and again and again. And, you know, again, I think thinking, for instance, of the American Revolution, some people like now to present it in terms of an anti-globalization revolt, in particular a revolt obviously against the power of the British monarchy, but also against the British multinational corporations at the time, the East India Company. And so the first act of the American Revolution, what we read about in the textbooks, the dumping of the tea into Boston Harbor, is primarily a protest against the East India Company, and primarily also a response to the idea that because of the actions of these big companies, people in North America were going to be reduced to the inferior status of low-wage laborers in India.
So really, it looks like it's more inequality than globalization that people are complaining about, right? Is inequality necessarily a byproduct of globalization, do you think?
It's, I think, statistically right that the periods of globalization have been the periods in which inequality increases. And the periods of deglobalization, spectacularly in the middle of the 20th century, have been the periods of decreasing inequality, because there's more scope then in the era of deglobalization for redistribution within a national framework.
You also write about the relationship between technology and globalization.
Yes.
And how that relationship has been behind human migration in the past. Talk to me a little bit about how that relationship works. And can you put that perhaps in the context of what Europe is facing now in terms of their immigration crisis?
Yes, the roots of migration are, I think, always complicated. There's often a pull factor as well as a push factor. The push factor that you can think of is to do with political and social collapse, so in societies that are collapsing when they're torn by civil war or foreign war, people will want to get out. But there have also been very important migrations in the past as a result of technical change affecting the way in which it's possible to earn a living from activities that used to be highly productive but are no longer productive. And so there's a mixture of all of these taking place in Europe. So quite a lot of the migration, the headline migration over the last years, is really the product of political collapse and disintegrating states. But there's also a movement because of social stagnation in Eastern Europe and in Southern Europe and Mediterranean Europe. And there's also a movement from the pull factor to countries that are particularly attractive and particularly dynamic. And most of the recent European migration within Europe just took place to three countries, to the UK, to Germany, and to Sweden.
Mm. Do you think that as the IMF historian, do you believe that economists generally pay enough attention to what's happened in the past when they're predicting what might happen in the future?
Well, the thing is, it's much easier to think of learning lessons from the very recent past. And I think people in the fund and elsewhere are really quite good at doing that we look at 2008 and what the lessons of 2008 are, or we look at the Asia crisis, the crisis of 97-98, and a lot of the fund's policy in the 21st century has been really formed by that business of learning the lessons from the Asian crisis. But there's obviously also a danger in just learning from the last crisis and not thinking of the broader sweep of things. And in some ways, the 19th century is particularly good at learning these lessons about the interplay of migration with technical change and also with social upheaval.
Hmm. Some people are surprised to hear that the IMF has engages historians. Has the institution always had a historian, and what are you hoping to achieve in your tenure?
Well, it's always had, almost always had, somebody who wrote the history. And there are these really very, very good histories that were begun by Keith Horsfield and continued by Margaret de Vries and then by James Boughton. And that goes up to 2000. So the new enterprise that Rex Ghosh and I are engaged in is the history of the fund after 2000. And it's obviously a particularly striking, dramatic history because it's also the history of the global financial crisis in the second half of these years. So one of the things I think in the past histories is that the fund is always confronted by new challenges. So Jim was looking at the Latin American debt crisis or the transformation of planned economies in the 1990s. And it's very clear that the global financial crisis has thrown up a whole range of issues that are really quite different to ones that existed, say, in the Latin American debt crisis or in the 1990s.
Do you foresee... you know, I guess given that it's a member, an institution of member countries, do you foresee any countries not seeing or not agreeing with your view of how things progressed during the financial crisis, for example?
Well, I think it's indeed true to say that countries disagree, or officials in countries disagree very much on many of these issues of interpretation. Was it global financial imbalances that led to the crisis? If so, what was the cause of those financial imbalances? Was it a particular kind of economic policy? I've just written a book. I just finished it before I started working on this fund history, where the main theme is that German and French economists and politicians just look at the world in different ways. If you think that's true, which I really profoundly do, it's obvious that all the members of the fund are never really going to agree on the interpretation of anything. But I think it's important to present the issues in a clear way. And in a sense, preparing the issues, presenting the issues, is a way of getting to better understanding. And in that sense, the historical process is one that also helps to make better policy when we're thinking about today and about the world of tomorrow.
That was Harold James, Professor of History and International Affairs at Princeton University and the new IMF historian. He was speaking about his article, New Concept, Old Reality, published in the December 2016 edition of Finance and Development magazine. The magazine is available online at imf.org/FND, or you can download the Finance and Development app to read it on your mobile device. You can hear more IMF podcasts like this one on iTunes or SoundCloud, or search for IMF Podcasts on your favorite podcast app.